Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. In this episode from the Dublin Festival of History 2023, Dublin City Council historian in residence Dr. Mary Muldowney will discuss the 40th anniversary of the 8th Amendment to the Constitution, including a comparison with the successful campaign for the repeal of the 8th. The 5th anniversary of that referendum was on the 25th of May, and the signing of repeal into law took place on the 18th of September 2018. Dr. Mary Muldowney is the Dublin City Council historian in residence for the Dublin Central Area. This episode was recorded at the Central Library on the 28th of September 2023.
Okay, looking at the age of the audience, I suspect that not too many of you were around in 1983. I was, and I'll come clean. I've been a pro-choice activist since 1983, so this is a one-sided historical approach. If anybody has a problem with that, tough. Anyway, what I want to talk about tonight is the referendum in 1983 that took the absolutely unconscionable step of making a medical procedure a matter of law and putting it into the Constitution. And thankfully, in the referendum on the 25th of May 2018, the people of Ireland voted overwhelmingly to repeal the Eighth Amendment. Now, there are still problems, but this was 25 years almost to the day since the overwhelming majority of those who voted in 1983 had rejected abortion. And it was presented to them as an inherently evil, not just a problem for men, but anti-Catholic and even anti-Irish. And during those 3.5 decades, multiple thousands of women travelled to Britain and elsewhere to avail of abortion services outside the state. And in addition to the 1983 referendum, of course, there were referendums on the issue in 92, which was the X case, and 2002. And finally, the 2018 proposal to repeal the 8th cleared the way for the induction of abortion as part of reproductive health services for women, but really on very limited terms. So I am going to show you some of the material from both sides that was used to persuade Irish voters to allow a constitutional change that was to make us almost unique in Europe in denying women the right to have a choice about accessing a full range of reproductive health services. For those of you who are obviously considerably younger than me, back in 1983, it wasn't just abortion that was outlawed, it was almost impossible to get contraception, which might seem a contradiction in terms, but we can talk about that later. This material that I'm going to show you tonight will include some from the print media, because that was particularly important back then, before there was internet available. It was vital, in fact, to political campaigning in those years. In the 2018 referendum, really the social media resources were used very widely by both sides. And as a historian, but also as an activist, I was very relieved to be able to have access to the computer records. I live in Stonybatter and in the middle of Dublin Central, where we had one of the biggest votes for repeal, but also where there were absolutely amazing numbers of especially young people who went out to canvass. And I was keeping track of all of those for the Central Committee. So I was aware of the huge change in attitude, even if I had never opened a paper or listened to the news. But in both 92 and 2002, as well as the two referendums I'm talking about tonight, canvassing was extremely important, that kind of personal touch of standing on someone's doorstep. But there has been a significant toning down of the message that was conveyed by the majority of anti-choice proponents between the two referendums over those 35 years. Now, I think it's been widely acknowledged that breaking the silence around abortion was one of the most influential elements of the 2018 campaign. There were brave young women who told their stories. That had happened, by the way, in 2002 when Bertie Ahern's government tried to overturn the little bit of hope that was there from the ex-judgment, even though they hadn't legislated. But you know, by the time we're looking for repeal of the Eighth so definitively over the last years before 2018, it really became very important, and there were various books that came out with people telling their personal story. In 1983, the Eighth Amendment didn't come from any particular concerted pressure for abortion rights. It was a very tiny minority who were demanding this. And really, the first serious discussion of the issue from the pro-choice side had come from the Women's Right to Choose group. And you see a couple of members there. The woman in the middle, by the way, is Mary Dorsey, the poet. And Marion O'Keefe in front is now about as old as myself. But the thing was that, you know, these were women who were before their time, really, and trying to raise the issue. So they were raising very good discussions, but not in a terribly public way because it wasn't feasible. But they were determined to change that. The referendum on abortion followed nearly a quarter century of unprecedented change in Ireland. But I have to say, women's rights were not high on very many agendas, even many women's. And the process of industrialisation that had been changing the country was also accompanied by increasing urbanisation and demographic change. So the growth of modern media, particularly television, improved communications, increased foreign travel, greater employment opportunities for women, and expanded education all contributed to major cultural change. And the forces that influenced the holding of the 1983 referendum and the embedding of the anti-abortion position in the Constitution saw themselves as challenging that change and asserting the traditional values as they saw them in defence of Irish culture. And I do the, you know, silly sign really, because Irish culture, since the foundation of the state, certainly, if not always actively anti-woman, certainly wasn't sympathetic to women's rights. So, you know, that defence was of a negative. However, the role played by the Catholic Church and its devotees was an intrinsic element of their defence. The anti-amendment campaigners were portrayed and, for the most part, saw themselves as the harbingers of a more open liberal society. And this would be one in which traditional authority figures would be replaced by political representatives who thought outside the old certainties of nationality and religion. But basically what they were looking for, what the more liberal people, was to have a representative democracy. We don't have one yet, but we're still trying. And there were three general elections between June 1981 and November 1982, in which Fianna Fáil, under Charles Hoghaigh, that charming, delightful man, was locked in battle with Garrett Fitzgerald's Fine Gael on several fronts, but not including women's rights. It didn't really matter to either party, the major party. Labour, under Frank Klusky, was ready to support Fine Gael, despite the fact that there would have been huge disparities in their approach to certainly Labour politics, apart from anything else. And Tomás McGill and the Workers' Party was the next biggest grouping, and it was rooted in opposition. So they weren't going to go into a coalition with either of the major right-wing parties, but equally, nobody was really talking very much about women's rights other than the Women's Right to Choose group. there wasn't really the need for a constitutional change because abortion was already illegal under the terms of the 1861 Offences Against the Person Act. So it had been illegal for a very long time. But in 1981, the pro-life amendment campaign, fondly known as PLAC, secured pre-election promises from both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to amend the constitution to ensure that abortion could not be introduced either by legislation or by the courts. And in the November 1982 election, a Fine Gael and Labour coalition was successful, and in March 83 they announced that a referendum would be held later that year in fulfilment of their pre-election undertaking. Despite these promises, abortion as a subject does not seem to have been an issue in any of those three elections, although there was one independent single issue candidate in Cork, a woman who received nearly 2,000 first preference votes in the February 1982 election, but her only platform was opposition to abortion. So, you know, it wasn't a widespread following that she had. And 80% of her votes transferred almost equally to Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, with only 13% of them going to Labour. Michael D. Higgins at the time had spoken out against the referendum, and his first preference votes in the Galway constituency declined by 22% between February and November 1982. So he paid a price for being liberal. What was evident in 2018 was the extent to which Irish people's perception of abortion had changed since 1983. A 1981 banner, which I have to say still amazes me every time I see it, featured the slogan, "The abortion mills of England grind Irish babies for blood that cries to the heavens for vengeance." They weren't too embarrassed about hyperbole in their... Anyway, it reinforced the notion of Irishness as encompassing moral rectitude from a particular viewpoint, from which women were tempted to stray by alien forces, because of course the poor dears can never make up their own minds about anything. But the underlying mistrust of women is still evident in the terms of the 2018 Health Act, the termination of pregnancy regulation, which came after the referendum, which requires a woman to wait 3 days between consulting her doctor and being able to have an abortion. So there's no such requirement attached to any other medical procedure. It's the only one. And the 83 pro-amendment campaign was conducted on very emotive lines that played effectively to an electorate that was still operating within a framework shaped by the Catholic Church's influence on the legislature. Remember, this is before all of the scandals became known about the Catholic Church's behaviour in so many awful situations. But there was equally no clear demand for abortion rights on the anti-amendment side, and the focus of the campaign was really to secure a rejection of the Eighth Amendment, and of course it was singularly unsuccessful in that regard. The Workers' Party produced a leaflet in 1983 advocating a no vote, but they didn't mention abortion once. Even more importantly, they didn't mention women. Many Catholic bishops and priests spoke out in favour of the amendment, but all the other mainstream churches opposed it. Fianna Fáil backed the proposal, Fine Gael was divided, and I think in the end Garrett Fitzgerald quite likely voted against it. The Workers' Party and more liberal forces generally opposed it, although all stressed that they were not advocating the legalisation of abortion. They were running like mad from that proposition. But even within these broad divisions, there were tensions between liberal and traditional elements in each of the parties. Both Haughey and Fitzgerald appeared to have allowed their fear of losing votes to overcome any scruples they might have had about their agreement with the PLAC. The passing of the 1967, I think I seem to be getting ahead of myself here, or else I've left something out. Anyway, sorry about that. The passing of the 1967 Abortion Act that legalised abortions in the United Kingdom, excluding Northern Ireland, was a source of controversy here. This was because Irish women were travelling in significant numbers to access the abortion services that had been made available by the passing of the 67 Act. And it wasn't until 1983, when the referendum to introduce a constitutional ban on abortion was announced, that pro-choice campaigners came together in any significant numbers. Nearly 67% of the valid poll, which was actually only just over half of the electorate, 53.67%, so 67% of 53% voted for the 8th Amendment. But given the deference to the Catholic Church, which was still very much a feature of Irish society at the time, this means that there was a very significant minority who chose to defy the Catholic bishop's instructions to vote for the amendment. Archbishop Kevin McNamara of Dublin was the author of a pamphlet that was published as part of Plaque's campaign literature, and the following extract illustrates the tone of the document. He wrote that a vote in favour of the amendment, as is a yes vote, will be a vote that some unborn children in the future will not be put to death, but allowed to be born and live. What condition they were living in, he doesn't mention. A vote against the amendment or failure to vote at all will be, whether one intends it or not, to opt for leaving the existing legal protection of the unborn child at risk and open to an unrelenting and ever-increasing attack. So the life, education, and I'm just going to skip over this. It was Life Education Research Network, or LEARN, published a booklet called Abortion Now in early 1983. One of the chapters was written by a woman called Loretta Brown, who had been a founding member of the Society for the Protection of the Unborn Child, or SPUC, and she summarised the perceived threat as follows. We must recognise the modus operandi of the anti-life lobby. It can truly be said that capitalism and Marxism are united in the fight for abortion on demand, the one for money, the other for ideological reasons. The average Russian woman has 6 abortions per lifetime, and in China, women pregnant for the third time are automatically aborted by law. Recalcitrants are forcibly brought to state abortion clinics while their husbands are imprisoned and the family home locked up. We must remember that those who chose to travel to Britain for abortions do so for social reasons. It is inconceivable that a woman whose life was deemed to be endangered would be advised to travel so far in an ill condition. Now, I didn't actually know the pregnancy was an illness, but, you know, I'm only a woman who's had 2 children and 2 grandchildren. Really... The statistics quoted there, I have never been able to find a source for, and I doubt their accuracy. Certainly there was an anti-more than one child policy in China for many years, but the other kind of sweeping generalisation is not the best. But from the opposing camp, there was an article by a woman called Mary Gordon, who was a member of the Women's Right to Choose campaign, and it was published in the Gralton magazine, which was a socialist journal. And it also considered the approach to contraception and abortion in Russia and China. And Mary wrote that it is surely an indictment of the so-called socialism of countries like Russia and China that in the former, the state denies women easy access to contraception because it wishes to increase the birth rate. And in the latter, the state penalises women if they have more than one child because it wishes to decrease the birth rate. Such politics are imposed. They do not flow from the full and equal participation of women in the decision-making processes. Any socialism which has a vested interest in denying women's liberation is not socialism. now as a socialist who's been arguing with male comrades for many generations about how important women's rights are. We haven't totally solved that problem either. But both sides used statements from experts like doctors and lawyers to support their arguments. And for the most part, the mainstream campaigns took a serious approach to the presentation of their literature. Others, like the members of People's Democracy, who produced a pamphlet entitled No More Chains, had previously been involved in campaigning for wider access to contraception. They had a campaign where they gave out free pencils and you got a condom as a prize for buying the pencil, or a donation for the pencil. And you can see an example of their humour there. But they were very frank in their approach to the information they disseminated, which was quite brave at the time, mainly because they were poking fun at the anti-abortion side in the cartoons that were included in the publication. I have a copy buried deep in my files, but I'm not sure if it's available anywhere else anymore, but it was highly entertaining as well as a serious document. But there really wasn't very much possibility of a meeting of minds on the issue. The referendum campaign in 1983 was particularly marked by the violence exhibited by some of the pro-amendment activists. Now, I only experienced verbal abuse, I have to say, but I'm aware, particularly in Meath for some reason, I think because there were two doctors there, Michael Rinn and his wife, who were campaigning actively against the amendment, but pig's blood was regularly thrown over canvassers and activists. And of course, nobody knew it was pig's blood at the time it was being thrown, so it must have been pretty horrific. This sort of trend continued through the subsequent decades and eventually resulted in a split between the more extreme elements of the anti-abortion groups and those who presented themselves as representing the views of the majority of the Irish people. An advisor to Garrett Fitzgerald suggested that the Taoiseach should address the country to calm the situation and even drafted the text of a speech, and there's an extract from it there. The speech was never delivered because apparently it never seemed like the right moment to do it. But you can see, you know, what it's talking about there, that politicians have to live with this kind of treatment. And if they've not got hides tough enough to stand it, they would be better off outside politics. But the political system itself becomes vulnerable when political parties themselves stoop to take advantage of the emotions aroused by such fanaticism, distorting the democratic process by doing so. Never thought I'd be agreeing with Fine Gaelers, but, you know, it's very accurate. And particularly when we think of the disgraceful scenes outside the Dáil last week, that unfortunately the democratic process is still under attack, and the level of personalisation of those attacks has increased enormously. I also never thought I'd find myself feeling sorry for Michael Healy-Ray, but there you go. So the insertion of the Eighth Amendment into the Constitution, of course, wasn't the end of the story, particularly for the founders of the PLIC. The organisation split in the aftermath of the referendum campaign between those who saw their victory as the start of a longer war against social liberalism and those who were satisfied that the issue had been put to bed with the ratification of the Eighth Amendment. Now, this man here, John O'Reilly, was a key figure in the PLAC at the time, and anybody who's can should read Emily O'Reilly's book from the time, in which she describes quite a lot about his role. But in a speech that he made in Rome in September 83, after the vote, it kind of summed up the intentions of the former group, those who were intending to fight on. He said, despite the amendment, the anti-amendment lobby is united and vigorous and will not go away. Well, that's true, but will continue to press on other sensitive areas. there's room for more caring organisations for unmarried mothers. There are pressures for sex education and for divorce, which should be resisted. And some of them are still doing that, though it's a bit late on the divorce. There are plans afoot to liberalise contraception even further. Horror. And as the amendment vote shows, the attitudes of the media are totally out of tune with popular opinion. But if the media remain as they are, popular opinion will eventually take its lead from the media. Well, yeah, but we didn't foresee social media at that stage and how pretty awful some of it can be. But there are many things to do which must be done. We know that if we retire from the fight, the advantage we have gained will be eroded, and that whilst we chose the battleground, we have the initiative. And they did go on to, you know, and people like O'Reilly were involved in the fight against divorce, against the legalisation of homosexuality, abortion, as we know, and marriage equality, among various other issues along the way. So most significantly for the governance of the country, while the passing of the Eighth Amendment was seen as a victory for the Irish Catholic Church, in the longer run, it was to contribute to increasing secularisation, particularly in light of revelations of child abuse and the Catholic hierarchy's collusion in covering it up. The kind of political engagement that was undertaken in 1983, the leaflets, the posters, the canvassing by political parties, large and small, and the role of various senior authority figures on both sides of the argument, were fundamentally not that different from the campaigns that were organised in respect of the call to repeal the Eighth Amendment. The key difference is, of course, the use of social media and online resources. On abortion, the balance between the forces on either side of the debate has shifted so radically since 1983, with a much more compassionate and mature approach to social issues being increasingly evident in the attitudes of voters. The proponents of social conservatism may not have retired from the fight, but their numbers have diminished significantly and they have suffered defeat after defeat. There is still a rump of misogyny that was evident in some of the interventions in the 2013 Dáil debate about the Health Regulation of Termination of Pregnancy Bill and elsewhere, but clearly many people who would not themselves choose to have an abortion have accepted that it is a personal decision and not one that should have been the political football it became in 1983. Opinion polls between 2002 and 2012 suggested that a majority of Irish people were in favour of abortion being made available in Ireland, albeit on limited grounds. Now, of course, we have to remember that what had happened in 1992 was the X case, when it became clear how horrifically having this as a constitutional issue could affect a 14-year-old child. The Irish government's inconclusive interventions in various court cases, the European Court, for instance, A, B and C cases, and in submissions to the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, were evidence of their ambivalence and the intention to allow abortion by default rather than initiating legislation. They were clearly trying to have their cake and eat it. You know, they seemed to be on the side of the anti-abortion people, but you know, because of popular opinion, it would slide through. Well, you know, they should know better. Things don't quite work like that, and especially when we've put it into the Constitution. So the government responded to the European Court's ruling by appointing an expert group to study the options. But the outrage, national and international, response to the tragic death of Savita Halappanavar on 28th of October 2012 forced the issue. The Irish abortion ban and the failure of successive governments to legislate for abortion as required by the X judgment left doctors with no legislative framework for dealing with complications in a pregnancy that threatened the life of the mother, as happened with Savita. In 2013, nearly 20 years after the Supreme Court delivered the X judgment, The Fine Gael Labour government delivered the Protection of Human Life and Pregnancy Act 2012 as their solution to the legislative lacuna that had led to the death of Savita. In contrast to the change attitude to abortion among the general public, evidenced by successive opinion polls, some of the arguments posed by opponents of the 2013 Act had not changed since the early 1980s. And really, it's quite depressing reading when you read the Dáil reports from the time. They did not at all reflect the much more nuanced approach adopted by so-called ordinary people concerning the role of abortion in women's reproductive health choices in Ireland. As you see, the figures here was almost complete reversal of the voting in 1983, except that thankfully more people came out. It was 64% of the electorate this time, because people clearly felt that this was a horrific thing to have put into the constitution and made it so difficult. But there's, in true Irish style, there was still a fair amount of ambivalence about the provision of abortion as a full service. So in July 2016, you remember, the government had established a citizens' assembly, and their remit at the time was to deliberate on the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution prior to further consideration of potential legislative change. And in April 2017, the Citizens' Assembly recommended by an overwhelming majority, 87%, that Article 40.3.3, which was the Eighth Amendment of the Irish Constitution, should not be retained in full. 56% of Assembly members voted that Article 40.33 should be replaced or amended, and 57% voted for a replacement of Article 40.33 with the constitutional provision authorising the Oireachtas to legislate. And 64% of the Assembly members voted in favour of access to abortion with no restriction as to reason. Which didn't go down well with some of the people who, again, in their testimony to the various inquiry committees, really had basically were saying, you can't trust women. You know, they'd be saying they're suicidal, or they'd be saying other sorts of things if you don't give them the right to control their own bodies. But a majority recommended 12 situations in which abortion should be lawful, and these included risk to the life of the woman, risk to the health of the woman, pregnancy that results from rape, fetal abnormality, including non-fatal, which is not the case still, socioeconomic reasons. And of course, that's always used as the big bugbear. Oh, it's just women not wanting to spoil their figures with pregnancy or whatever. Socioeconomic reasons, of course, as we know, and I'm preaching to the converted here, I'm sure, but can actually include the fact that you can't afford to pay for an abortion and you can't afford to go out of the country, and you still need to do if it goes past a certain date. So in August of 2017, the United Nations Committee Against Torture had accused the Irish government of causing severe physical and mental anguish and distress to women and girls as a result of the state's policies on abortion. The Joint Committee on the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution was appointed by the government to consider the recommendations of the Citizens' Assembly with regard to abortion and the repeal of the amendment. The Joint Committee met regularly between June and December 2017, considering evidence presented by national and international experts on abortion care, reproductive health and human rights. Their report was published on the 20th of December that year, recommending that abortion should be lawful in Ireland where the life or the physical or mental health of the woman is at risk, or in cases as fatal as distinct from non-fatal fetal anomaly, and on a woman's own indication of up to 12 weeks pregnancy, provided that the termination is carried out in a clinical setting. So it was a move forward, but it wasn't anything like what was being looked for, and still had huge barriers against some women. Following debate in the Dáil between 17th and 25th of January 2018, during which 80 speakers contributed in 17 hours of statements about the Joint Committee's recommendations, Minister of State David Stanton summarised the position. And he said the main conclusion of the committee is that change is needed to extend the grounds for lawful termination of pregnancy in the state. In order to effect that change, the committee recommended that Article 40.33 should be removed from the Constitution. The committee then went on to make recommendations on the grounds on which the termination of pregnancy should be permitted in Ireland if the article is repealed. It recommended extending the law on abortion to cover cases where the health of a woman was concerned, cases of fatal fetal abnormalities, and a broader legal regime that allows abortions from a medical practitioner for pregnancies of under 12 weeks gestation. Now, that is still a major problem because, you know, due to the opportunity for doctors to opt out of offering any kind of abortion referral or advice, the 12 weeks can often go by. I mean, I think I mentioned that I had two children, and my first one, I didn't actually know I was pregnant until it was about 4 or 5 months in. Now, it wasn't a problem for me, but I actually just thought I was putting on weight. Very naive. But then we didn't have proper sex education or contraception then. But it's taken 35 years, and I hate to think that, you know, we ran that much, but unimaginable distress and hardship for tens of thousands of Irish women, not just Irish women, but mainly Irish women because they were here. Refugees and asylum seekers are a whole extra case of hardship, but they weren't even being thought about for most of the time by politicians. They finally had to stop avoiding the issue and a woman's right to bodily autonomy. Agreeing to call a referendum was not the end of the battle, as the proposal to repeal the Eighth Amendment was only the first step in securing a full reproductive health service, assuming that the electorate supported it in the first place. And this couldn't be taken for granted, as the anti-choice forces were extremely well resourced, not just from Ireland. So in previous campaigns on abortion, both sides had formed umbrella organisations to carry out the task of persuading the electorate to their point of view. Together for Yes spearheaded the campaign for a Yes vote, and it was noticeable from an early stage in the movement that there was a significant difference in how the issue was posed to voters. In the aftermath of Savita Halappanavar's death, many of the groups that formed to demand the right to choose abortion in their own country were not disguising their anger anymore at the way women had been treated. Many women were prepared to tell their stories publicly, breaking the silence and stigma that had shadowed the issue of crisis pregnancies for so long. This was to be a critical tool in persuading the undecided, and even some opponents of abortion to change their minds and trust women to make their own choices about their health. So as the directors of the Together for Yes campaign noted in their thank you message to the 1,429,981 people, I love that figure, who voted for repeal of the Eighth Amendment, he said, without the massive support of people in every county in Ireland, this momentous vote would not have been possible. We thank all those who shared their stories and everyone who spoke out for the need to change. We thank the thousands of volunteers across the country who campaigned tirelessly for a better Ireland, now and over many decades. Following the referendum on 25th of May 2018, the Eighth Amendment was formally removed from the Irish Constitution and replaced with the new Article 40.33, which stated that provision may be made by law for the regulation of termination of pregnancy by the 36th Amendment of the Constitution Act 2018. Now, that was not without legal challenges by, I can't remember where the guy came from, but he had some spurious legal argument as to why the vote of so many people in Ireland should have been overturned. Thankfully, it was thrown out. It was signed, the Act of the Health Regulation and Termination of Pregnancy Act was signed into law in December 2018 by President Michael D. Higgins. So while it is an improvement on the previous situation, it continues to curtail women's rights in Ireland. The legislation demands a 3-day cooling-off period, so-called, for abortion on request, which is hardly abortion on demand, as the opponents of choice like to claim. Abortions are only lawful up to 12 weeks of pregnancy, regardless of the circumstances, including rape. In the horrific case where a pregnant woman is told her fetus has been diagnosed with a fatal fetal anomaly, the death of the fetus must be expected within 28 days of birth or after the diagnosis. So it really is condemning a woman if it's diagnosed at an early enough stage to maybe months of carrying around a child that is not ever going to be delivered or will be delivered dead. While the legislation offers free abortions to Irish citizens and women living here permanently, this is a very grey area for asylum seekers and refugees who are housed in direct provision and likely to have restricted capacity to travel apart from the very limited incomes that they get. So the legislation does not decriminalise medical or other personnel who assist a woman with an abortion outside the limitations imposed by the law, although it does at least remove the previous criminalisation of women who terminated their own pregnancies. There are other shortcomings in the Act, which was reviewed in 2021, 3 years after its implementation, which was a provision of the Act. The review was published in May of this year and passed over to the Dáil Joint Committee on Health for consideration about next steps. And, of course, they haven't made any recommendations yet. However, in the meantime, statements from the Taoiseach and other senior political figures suggest a level of distrust that is worryingly consistent with the anti-woman discrimination that drove the creation of the Eighth Amendment in the first place. So, as I said at the beginning, it's obvious which side I'm coming from on this. But really, as a normal human person of a certain gender, I don't really see how you can present this in any other way. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Dublin Festival of History. The festival is brought to you by Dublin City Council and organised by Dublin City Libraries, in partnership with Dublin City Council Culture Company. For further podcast episodes and for all the latest festival news, be sure to visit dublinfestivalofhistory.ie or follow us on Instagram.